Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Nora Volkov, director of the National Institute on Drug Addiction at the National Institutes of Health, which just observed National Addiction Recovery Month. Dr. Volkov is one of the early brain imaging pioneers whose work has shown that addiction is a disorder of the brain, and their recent research has shown that those suffering from substance use disorder are more likely to become infected with COVID-19 and to have worse outcomes. Laurie Robertson also checks in. Managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at a statement spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Nora Volkov here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Nora Volkov, director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, at the National Institute of Health, which supports most of the world's research on drug addiction. She has pioneered the use of brain imaging technology to gain greater insight into how addiction functions as a disorder of the brain.
Dr. Volkov was Director of Nuclear Medicine and Medical Department Chair at the Department of Energy's Brookhaven Nuclear Laboratory. She has published nearly 800 peer-reviewed articles, earned numerous awards and distinctions, including Time Magazine's Top 100 People Who Shape Our World and Innovator of the Year by U.S. News & World Report. Dr. Volkov, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Dr. Volkov, you know, we're in the midst of this pandemic, but it's also overshadowed another deadly epidemic America has been grappling with in substance use disorder and addiction and overdoses, mostly from opioids, led to some 70,000 deaths last year in the US. And at NIDA, you recently conducted research on the connection between those with substance abuse disorder and the susceptibility to COVID-19. And you found a distinct correlation and worse outcomes. And I'm wondering if you could share with our audience and maybe put this in some perspective, how the addiction crisis is dealing with the backdrop of the pandemic and what impact you were seeing.
Yeah, and the origin for the study came about because of the concern that people that were taking drugs, and certainly in the case of opioid use disorder, they would have many of the physiological abnormalities that have been recognized to increase the risk for adverse outcomes of COVID, such as pulmonary pathology, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome. But the other one being the social structural aspects that relate to substance use disorder would make the persons much more likely to end up homeless, to end up in shelters, to end up in jail or prison or places where infection disseminates very, very rapidly. So we wanted to see, based on electronic health records, whether there was any data that would help us illuminate this. And what the analysis showed was, indeed, individuals with substance use disorder had higher risk of becoming infected with COVID. And if they got infected with COVID, they were much more likely to be hospitalized and to die.
Well, Dr. Volkov, we've just marked National Recovery Month, September, and this is a very good time to stop and talk about this issue, because in addition to how addiction affects people being infected with COVID, I think we've also seen with this complete kind of uproar, as you indicated, in our social systems, the isolation, the loss of social network has really led to, I would think, a higher rate of relapse and perhaps even new onset addiction. Can you talk about that, this collision of a pandemic and the already existing epidemic of drug abuse, how just the rates of addiction and substance use disorder are changing during this period?
Yeah, and it is a very worrisome situation, because there are two elements that make this combination of the COVID pandemic and the opioid crisis so malignant. We recognize that one of the most powerful tools that we have to help people overcome the urges to take drugs and to achieve recovery is meaningful social interactions. And with the social distancing, that has become much harder to do. And also many of the treatment programs that existed or community services that provide that social opportunity to be with others, to be actually feel that you have value of some level, has been eroded. That's one element. And the other element that also makes it so dangerous is that one of the other factors that leads to drug taking is stress. And that is one of the main causes of relapse. And here we are amidst COVID with a lot of uncertainties, with a loss of jobs, with a loss of loved ones, with our lifestyle completely changed and not knowing when it's going to come back.
Right.
And that level of uncertainty is making everyone anxious, I mean, to a greater or lesser extent. But one of the ways that people cope is by taking more drugs, whether it's alcohol, whether it's smoking marijuana, whether it's vaping nicotine, or by overeating. I mean, if you have a problem with a substance use disorder, that reaching out to take drugs can have very dire consequences.
You know, Dr. Volkov, it has long been believed that addiction is the result of moral failings. But it was your pioneering work in brain imaging of people under the influence of many drugs dramatically flipped that notion. And your early experiments in neuroimaging opened our eyes to the biochemical response at play. It's been the first real window into the altered brain process at play. And I wonder if you could help us understand what kind of breakthrough this has been for addiction science, leading to really huge leaps in understanding how these syndromes work in the brain.
It was very useful to have information that related to, first of all, clear objective documentation that the brain of people that were addicted differ in very specific ways from that of individuals that were not addicted. They delineated through imaging the biochemical abnormalities that happens in people that are addicted. It gave us insight about why is it that people that are addicted to drugs make such poor choices, and why, despite the catastrophic consequences that come from taking these drugs, are unable to inhibit their strong urges to take the drugs. And out of that research, it became clear that one of the systems in the brain that is most profoundly affected is the prefrontal cortical areas of the brain that are necessary for us not just to make a decision on what our actions are going to be, but very importantly, to carry them through. So it's not enough to say for me, no, I'm not going to do that. It is the subsequent step is my capacity to stay on in terms of in the goal that I'm trying to achieve. And those processes require the proper function of the prefrontal cortex, and drugs erode them. And so this provided an insight, not just that addiction is a disorder of the brain, but also why is it the presentation, the behavioral presentation of addiction.
You know, I'd like to add, if we could, to our conversation about opioids and alcohol and nicotine, and that's food and food addiction, also a huge problem in this country and a particular risk factor for consequences of COVID. We've certainly seen with obesity being implicated in that. Your brain imaging work has also helped us learn more about how the brain drives our response to food. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the connection between brain activity or brain pathology and food addiction, which takes such a heavy toll in people across America. It's just shocking, the percent of the adult population that's now obese in states across the country. What's the relation there between brain addiction and food addiction?
Well, the question that rose in my brain when we were doing all of these studies in addiction, and we were delineating common areas that were disrupted regardless of whether it was alcohol or heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine. And what it seemed to indicate was that the disruption of those regions of the brain was associated with inability to exert self-regulation, to inhibit this prepotent response to things that we desire. And so I was curious to know whether this was just a function of the chemical pharmacological effects of the drugs, or whether other conditions had similar type of disruption. And that's why we started to study whether in people that were morbidly obese, we could delineate the similar pathology. Definitely, there are very significant overlap between the loss of control in someone that cannot stop eating and that in addiction. But overall, it does identify that the brain responds to very powerful rewards in the same way. Number one, it's the aspect about it being a powerful reward, and drugs are very powerful rewards. Obesogenic food can be very powerful in the context of what other alternatives you have. So if you don't have alternatives, that brain doesn't have much of a chance. Uh-huh. And so you are much more likely to fall into a compulsive pattern that favors that behavior. And that in turn triggers the neuroadaptations that strengthen the links between what is salient and your actions. And it can become almost an automatic behavior. And that is what the studies with in obesity reveal to us, that were common with the process of addiction. And not everybody has choices, and the level of stress varies for many of us. And it's important to convey this to people, that one of the ways that one may aim to escape, to auto-medicate this state of anxiety, maybe overeating or over-drinking alcohol, or as I mentioned, smoking marijuana. These are ways that we cope. That could be very harmful to your health.
Mm-hmm. That's a great observation. We're speaking today with Dr. Nora Volkoff, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, or NIDA, at the National Institute of Health. She's pioneered the use of brain imaging technology to gain insights into addiction as a disorder of the brain. Margaret was just talking about the many addictions, and obviously food, but also nicotine addiction has been looming large over many decades. But we've seen this dramatic drop in smoking in this country. And yet 15% of the population still smokes, leading to nearly 500,000 preventable deaths each year. And we saw a great reduction in smoking for the youngest demographics until vaping products hit the market, really leading to this really dramatic rise in nicotine use and addiction. The tobacco industry understands all too well how nicotine works on the brain. I'm wondering if you could talk about the work you're doing at NIDA to assess the impact of this unfortunate uptick in nicotine addiction due largely to vaping.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad you're bringing it up, because it's, again, an example about how something that in principle appeared to be so benign, vaping nicotine, in principle had advantages over using combustible tobacco, because you were not burning tobacco, which has many of the chemicals responsible for its carcinogenesis. And then we have come to realize, first of all, it's not so safe in terms of affecting negatively pulmonary function. But importantly, it's a fantastic delivery system for nicotine or for cannabis or for any drug that you can actually vaporize. I mean, in terms of marketing, the ability to put a nicotine mixed with an extraordinary diverse and appealing set of flavors in very sleek devices like the Juul,
right,
make it extraordinarily appealing for adolescents and young people. And we've seen an embracing of that technology like we have never seen increases in drug use, from almost nothing into 1 out of 4 12th graders having vape nicotine in the past month, and many, almost half of all teenagers having been exposed to it. So the concern also is that when you vape, you can concentrate the fluid that if you're vaping nicotine at very, very high content. And you can actually go from never having taken nicotine whatsoever into very high doses very rapidly, which is not what happens when you're smoking tobacco, because the harshness of that tobacco can be very aversive. So it takes several months to get at higher levels. And that's not what we're seeing with nicotine vaping. We're seeing people getting exposed to very, very high levels of nicotine very rapidly, which makes it even so much more addictive and also toxic. Nicotine at high doses can be very toxic. So we are very concerned that indeed the uptick of nicotine vaping by teenagers and young people will increase the vulnerability that they turn into combustible tobacco. And indeed, there's data from prospective studies that have shown that if you are vaping nicotine and they follow you through, you're much more likely to then be a smoker of regular tobacco than if you have never initiated with nicotine vaping. And among young people, there's another issue of concern, and which is nicotine is, in that respect, it's a scary drug, because what it does is when you have nicotine on board, which, by the way, has a very short half-life, it makes anything you are doing so much more salient. And so if you are working on a paper and you're vaping, it will be able to grab your interest so much more. And if you have nicotine on board and you take another drug, it will make that drug so much more exciting. So in that way, it's a substance that can enhance the reinforcing value of other drugs.
It's a force multiplier.
It's a force multiplier. That's a very good way of describing it. And our greatest concern always goes with young people, because their brain is so much more neuroplastic and changes much more rapidly. Right. So that transition from initiation of drug taking into loss of control and addiction is much faster.
I wonder if we could expand on that to some of your work looking at the links between substance use disorder and other mental and behavioral health issues. You know, your research has been quite expansive, and you've looked at conditions such as schizophrenia to ADHD, complex conditions that can be difficult sometimes to properly diagnose and to manage. What are we learning from your research in these other brain disorders and hopefully finding better ways to treat them? Certainly, there's been lots of advances. What are we learning now? What's the most current?
Well, we're expanding our knowledge very, very rapidly as we are actually generating these large databases of these disorders. One of the reasons why I basically not just limited the work on research in terms of addiction and obesity is that since a lot of the work that I've done is focused very much on the brain dopaminergic system. And the brain dopaminergic system is just brilliant. It actually is a solution to by nature to actually motivate our actions to do things that will keep us alive, but to prevent us from those things that would hurt us. And by that very simple way of making something positively reinforcing and making it negatively reinforcing the things that are bad, nature can accommodate a widespread set of behaviors. So definitely in terms of food, rewarding, if it tastes good, it feels good, you seek it out. Pain, you basically avoid it. And so that has worked. And it also extends in our social interactions and our ability also to learn things. Learning is very reinforcing. Understanding something is extraordinarily pleasurable. And that's why we have games and that's where, for example, the question as it relates to ADHD, I mean, kids or adults that have ADHD cannot sustain attention. It doesn't grab them unless what they are doing is very appealing to them. So the issue being that to what extent the problem in their attention is in fact driven by a motivation deficit. So that you need to energize whatever action that person has to do with ADHD in order to sustain the effort. And that's what stimulant medications do. They enhance dopamine. But also it opens up the door on saying if a kid with severe ADHD can spend hours video gaming, why is it that we don't learn what video gaming is doing in order to apply to educational material so it becomes more salient? So the dopaminergic system, which is at the essence that creates habits with addiction, is fundamental for our activities as humans, for many, many organisms. But for us, it's crucial. And disruption of those systems can set the balance in ways that can be very negative. So, for example, working schizophrenia, what they have shown is that the saliency of the dopaminergic system is ascribed to delusional thinking, to hallucinations. And so that has a higher weight in your brain. The moment that you imprint a dopamine signal at the same time that you are exposed to something else, that becomes salient. And so that's where the thinking has been going on. And as we know very clearly, the main type of medications that we use to treat the psychosis and schizophrenia are drugs that interfere with dopaminergic signaling through the dopamine D2 receptor. So this is how crucial this system is for our well-being and our survival, and how important it is for mental illnesses and for neurological disorders.
Well, Dr. Volkoff, that was a wonderful illumination of so many things, and thank you so much. And you've said this so well, and you did in your well-received TED Talk, and your testimony to Congress in regards to addiction is we know what to do, we're just not doing it. And policy plays such an important role in driving necessary public health interventions that will better treat addiction and hopefully prevent it, right? And I'm wondering if you could talk about what you know works and where you'd like to see policymakers, payers, and healthcare institutions really focus their resources and where is the greatest need, but also the greatest opportunity to make a meaningful impact on addiction.
Well, we know many evidence-based interventions that work for prevention, but in general terms, I would say, that children and adolescents are at its more plastic, and those, it's not surprising that adverse events, whether it is stress, neglect, drug exposures, improper nutrition, have much worse consequences when they happen during childhood and on adolescence. Mm-hmm. And those doing interventions that can protect and buffer the situation, the environmental situations that put these children at greater risk is fundamental. And there is, to me, and as you think about it and says, well, how do you bring forward a prevention that's going to be effective? What would be some of the elements that you want to be certain that you're working with? And one of them that is crucial is providing alternative to for children to develop, providing alternative for children to educate, and providing alternative to children and, of course, young people to have meaningful social relationships. The moment that you curtail the opportunities for a person where that individuals feel that they don't have any mission, that they are not appreciated, that is opening up the door for a much greater vulnerability for substance use disorders, mental disorders, and other behavioral conditions. So, and as I see it, one of the key components is education. Providing quality education to every single child and young person is one of the most effective prevention interventions that we can do, while ensuring family support to those populations that are very disenfranchised, that don't have the resources to pay attention to the children, to give them the incentives and the belief that they actually are unique and create their self-confidence. So supporting families in order to be able for someone to take care of the child and not having to work two or three shifts every single day so that the children are neglected. One of the most adverse things that you can do to the human brain on a child is neglected. The brain is extraordinarily complex and it's building itself. And so if you do not provide with the challenges, guess what? It doesn't develop. And that puts that child as a terrible disadvantage. And so creating a system that will buffer individuals that come from systems that are socioeconomically very stressed, that don't provide opportunities, is probably one of the most important things that we can do for the next generation. And once we do it for that next generation, guess what? That next generation, their children won't have to grapple with these problems. Mm-hmm. So it's an investment that pays into the future. And that's why sometimes it's so frustrating and says, we do know that it works and it has an enormous impact, but it's not immediate. And that's, I think, part of the problem, the challenges. Our brain favors things that give you an immediate gratification, whether it's individual or as a population. And those policies that can show a huge return into the future are dismissed on the basis of policies that can give you an immediate sort of result right away, even though that effect will be very, very limited. And I think that as a society, we need to grapple that we have to change our priorities, mm-hmm. and recognize the need to invest into goals that are into the future, but with much greater payoffs, such as prevention for substance use disorders.
Well, that is a great note to end on. We've been speaking today with Dr. Nora Volkov, Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. You can learn more about her vitally important work by going to drugabuse.gov or follow her and her colleagues on Twitter at NIDA News or Facebook at NIDA NIH. Dr. Volkov, we want to thank you for your incredible contributions to the field of neuroscience, leading to a greater understanding of the complexities of addiction and other disorders of the brain, and for your forward focus on making things better for the next generation. Thank you for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
At a CNN town hall in September, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden misleadingly claimed, quote, "The president of the United States said that no longer would we in fact provide masks for schools, pay them to have the masks in school because it was not a national emergency. One federal program to pay for masks ended, but another aims to distribute up to 125 million masks for schools." NPR reported on September 1st that the Federal Emergency Management Agency's Assistant Administrator for Recovery told state and tribal emergency managers that FEMA would stop on September 15 reimbursing states for cloth masks and other personal protective equipment for places that are deemed non-emergency locations, including schools. But that doesn't mean the federal government isn't providing any masks to schools. The same NPR story noted the Department of Health and Human Services would provide up to 125 million masks to schools. HHS's Public Health Emergency webpage includes that information, saying HHS would provide the masks to states for distribution to schools. Quote, "The administration intends for these masks to support students, teachers, and staff in public and private schools reopening with an emphasis on students who are low income or otherwise with high needs and schools providing in-person instruction." NPR also said states may stock up on such protective equipment before the FEMA policy went into effect. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Daniela Tudor had a revelation a few years ago, waking up on the cold floor of a jail cell. She could ask for help for her drug and alcohol addiction, or she could die. She chose the former. Tudor then launched not only on her own recovery journey, but on a broader quest to develop tools that could help all people grappling with addiction recovery to avoid relapse, which is so common, especially in the early days of sobriety. She realized that there needed to be more readily accessible tools for those in recovery to stay connected to their treatment goals beyond the 12-step meetings and the talk therapy sessions.
I am in long-term recovery, and I went through a four-week inpatient treatment program where at the end of that four-week program, all I received was a piece of paper that listed an enormous amount of things I'm supposed to do on a daily and weekly basis for the rest of my life to stay in recovery. And I knew that building something on our cell phones that are with us 24/7, regardless of where you're from and who you are, would be a way to bridge that gap and keep people accountable through an app to those activities.
So she founded We Connect, a relapse prevention on-the-go mobile application that can be downloaded on a smartphone. The platform is designed to keep people engaged in their recovery plan using daily reminders and a reward system for when you perform the tasks that are essential to recovery.
The individual, along with the support of our certified peer recovery support specialists, are able to input those activities into the app. And when it comes time for that activity to start, you simply check into it. You see at the top of the app how you're earning your incentives. And by the way, this incentive program is based on evidence-based research called contingency management. So it's actually proven to show that it keeps people accountable to their recovery plans or their care plans. The way that we've digitized it and the immediacy of that incentive keeps people accountable to checking into those activities on the go.
And the digital platform also allows everyone who's connected to the person's healthcare ecosystem to see in real time activities that are enhancing recovery and also when one might be at higher risk for relapse.
We have trained peer recovery support specialists all across the country, and they get to leverage a tool that we developed called a data dashboard, where they can see in an instance if someone needs additional support or outreach. And that is built through the app, keeping them accountable to those activities and the peer having insights on how they're staying accountable to those activities in real time. So it really allows for this connection of support 24/7 and visibility so that when someone needs that added support, you know, not days or weeks go by, which is without this program is what happens, but rather gives insight and gives the option for connection in real time.
Since the pandemic hit, Tudor says the We Connect platform has been a lifeline for those in recovery, those now often cut off from meetings and in-person sessions during the shutdown.
Actually, when the pandemic hit, immediately my heart went out for, wow, none of us have support meetings to go to anymore in person. So we immediately stood up with a set of partners, these mutual aid meetings that are online, that are led by certified peers. And within just a couple months, over 200,000 people joined from all states and several countries.
We Connect, a downloadable app designed by people in recovery for people in recovery to help maintain sobriety with a support system in the palm of their hand, keeping them on track with health goals, staying connected to a care team, and avoiding relapse. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.